Hello and welcome back to the Edge of the Box podcast of podcastbywhoscored.com in association with Ultimate Fan. I'm your host, Dan Bardell, joined by Jonathan Wilson and George Ellick to discuss the weekend's Premier League action. And you can be blamed, you know, when I woke up this morning, I thought I was hosting Good Morning Britain. So I was getting up to do this podcast. It's 7 a.m. We've had to do it early. We've waited till the Friday morning so that we can discuss the football in a bit more detail, because, of course, there was a couple of crucial games in the Premier League on Thursday night. Jonathan, one of those was Chelsea against Manchester United. We're going to talk about Manchester United versus Liverpool in a moment. But what a crazy game. Two football teams that have got no tactical plan whatsoever.
Yeah, I mean, I did sort of think... I thought it was a game we could go one of two ways. Either it was going to be the sort of nonsense affair it was and loads of fun and no defending, or both managers would think, you know what, we've been really, really open recently. We're going to close this down. We'll first priority to keep a clean sheet. But yeah, thankfully it was the former. So yeah, with the staggered kickoffs, obviously I watched Liverpool Sheffield United till halftime, managed to miss the first Chelsea goal. I then watched Chelsea be totally on top, give United a goal, saw the Sheffield United scored, flicked over, and the next thing I know, somehow United have equalised. Yeah, Chelsea absolutely battered United that first sort of 20, 25 minutes of that Caicedo pass. And I think that, you know, that's exactly why Chelsea are mid-table. They, at times, they look very good going forward. I think, I mean, he didn't play brilliantly last night, but I think Nicholas Jackson, since Christmas, has been really good for them. Cole Palmer, obviously, having a great season, was brilliant last night. And you can see the sort of attacking pattern there, but defensively, they're awful. And United, I was at the Brentford game last week, and that was a game they should have lost. Yeah, Brentford hammered them. And Ten Hag in the press conference afterwards, he was asked, are you worried by how many shots you're conceding? And he says, well, as long as we're getting results. He said, what? That can't be right. You must know, if you're conceding 20-odd shots a game, and at that point they were conceding an average of 21 shots per game over the previous 13 games, because it's 25, I think, last night. So it's more than 21 shots a game. Well, given that as a rough rule of thumb over the whole history of football, 9 shots equal a goal, you're conceding 2.5 goals a game. That's you can't be happy with that. And you look at the way they set up, the defence seems to stay reasonably deep, and then the forward line presses, and you have this enormous hole in the middle. And yeah, you look time and again at chances United concede, and you think, oh, where's the back of their midfield? And then you realise that is just how they play. They just don't have a midfield. And so Cole Palmer got so much space in that area last night, Conor Gallagher as well, sort of playing the sort of almost with 2 10s. And you think, well, of course they do, because Pochettino can see, as any coach can see, as anybody who's watched football can see, there's a massive space there. Just put your most creative players there and they will score, they will get joy. So, yeah, it didn't. I mean, I say it didn't surprise me. It was 4-3. I'd gone for 2-1 in the predictions, but you could feel the sort of nonsense 6-7-8 goals coming, and they did.
Yeah, I mean, even George, when it got back to 3-3, which is obviously a hammer blow at that point in the game, United have been having the game in the palm of their hands, as I said last night on Twitter, as you know, George. They get back to 3-3. Chelsea's first attack. Man, you've got no defence whatsoever, and they end up conceding the corner. How can you be so open from a kickoff? It just doesn't make any sense.
And not only that, it was also the way that they conceded from the corner as well. Like, I haven't seen... It was like watching a computer game where, like, you call over one of your players out of the box and they just kind of trot over unchallenged. Like, there's that still that's been doing the rounds on Twitter of all the United players just pointing at Palmer, all of them looking at one another thinking, you know, someone go and get him, and no one goes and gets him, and he just receives the ball and has so much time to shoot. And the deflection helps him out. But to be unable to put in just kind of the bare effort needed in order to close Palmer down and actually go with him to prevent him having that shooting opportunity in the 101st minute is wild. Like, United are just, you know, if I was a United fan, I'd be probably more concerned about the seeming disregard that Ten Hag has around these statistics that clearly show they're not a functioning football team than I would be about the performances themselves. Like, it can't continue like this. And they're, you know, they're, if they'd got through yesterday, even with a point, but it looked like it was going to be 3 points for the majority of the game. It would have been another result that's just purely papering over the cracks. And I almost think for United, the best thing possible for them is for their deficiencies to be exposed to the extent that the change has to come in the summer, because we know that with Ineos now in, you know, they will be, I can be pretty confident they're going to take a lot more of a view on the underlying numbers and even the kind of the very basic shot numbers that we talk about, and see the warning signs. And I personally would be pretty surprised if Ten Hag is still there at the beginning of next season.
Yeah, I think that result last night, Jonathan, might have finished Ten Hag. I always think in his post-match interviews as well that he's quite deluded, but I actually think that game and the way they threw it away, I think that probably seals it, in my opinion.
Maybe. I mean, why that one more than, you know, they were battered at Brentford. Yeah, there's countless terrible performances, terrible results this season. Maybe just the cumulative weight of it all. Maybe there is something about, you know, you're 3-2 up going into injury time and you end up losing the game. And not just by getting done by two brilliant strikes or, you know, two freakish deflections or something. Getting done because you concede in sort of half a dozen chances in injury time. Maybe that is it. But I did wonder after the Liverpool game whether that the nature of that win might be enough to sort of kindle something for Ineos to think, yeah, the players are still playing for him. There's still some kind of spirit there. And, you know, the comparison was made to the game against Nottingham Forest in 1990, the Mark Robins goal that saved Fergie's job. And if you look around that time, you know, Manchester United's results after that game were horrendous. You know, I think they lost at home at Derby in the league the following game. I think they lost the game after that. They were 2 points off relegation at the time. So if you're drawing a direct comparison, this is better than then in that they're not in any sort of relegation danger. But yeah, football has changed since then. The wealthier clubs don't get in that same kind of bother. And I think also, almost more than results, I think Ineos have been concerned by how poor some of the transfers have been that Ten Hag has clearly been involved in. Anthony being the obvious one. Well, though, he actually played in patches last night. So I'd be really surprised if Ten Hag's still there next season. I suppose there's a possibility that given how many big clubs are looking for managers, there is maybe a possibility Ineos sort of hold fire. They get Dan Ashworth in place, they get the back room in place, and only act after that and think, okay, let the dust settle. But I think he'd have to do something pretty spectacular to keep hold of his job.
Yeah, Ben, George, people talk about them chasing Villa and Spurs down in for the Champions League places. I think last night probably finishes that as well. There's a danger that teams like Wolves could come up and actually take a European spot from them full stop. They're closer to falling out of the top six than they are to breaking into the top five.
Well, I think Chelsea are the ones where, if you consider Chelsea have Sheffield United this coming weekend, United have Liverpool, and the probability is that Chelsea pick up 3 points against Sheffield United and United lose to Liverpool. And if that's the case, then suddenly Chelsea are, 2 points behind United with a game in hand. So on points per game, they'd be ahead of United. So I think last night I saw quite a few people, again, on social media saying it was a game that didn't really matter. But I don't think that's true. I think Chelsea still have a massive opportunity here to get past United and get back into Europe, which I think for them, given their difficulties, would be at least something that would suggest a step in the right direction. But yeah, I don't think United will finish in the top six, personally. I think their trajectory is very much downward from here to the end of the season, with teams behind them being able to close the gap further and probably overtake them.
Yeah, and Jonathan, it was Liverpool in action last night as well, beating Sheffield United 3-1. Slightly hairy 10 or 15 minutes or so when Sheffield United got back into the game. But as Liverpool have done all season, really, they just find a way of winning. And they do just keep churning out results, don't they?
Yeah, and I think there's two ways looking at that. So it's a little bit the same with Brighton game the on Sunday, that there's spells of both of those games where you think, you can't get away with this. Like, this is not a healthy way to conduct a title challenge. I mean, obviously they're top of the table with 8 games to go, so it's technically not a terrible way to conduct a title challenge.
Pretty healthy.
But putting yourself in jeopardy, I mean, even the number of times they've gone behind this season, putting yourself in jeopardy I'm not sure you're always going to get away with it, but at the minute they are always getting away with it. And getting away with it maybe is too negative a term, because that period where they scored the second and third goals, Liverpool were brilliant last night. You often see teams with all the ball sort of hammering on the door. But this is, Liverpool seem to do it with greater pace, with greater imagination, greater variety of angles, greater capacity to score from range. I didn't really have a doubt Liverpool were going to score. That they'd had a couple of chances even before the McAllister goal. And then once they got the goal, it was only going to be them scoring more. So I think it's 26 goals they've now scored in the last 15 minutes of games. And the next highest is 16 in the Premier League this season, which is an extraordinary stat. Now, partly that's because they've needed to score late in games. So it's a bit like the game against Newcastle when I think they got the record number of shots in a game. Or maybe it was a record XG, wasn't it, in a game. But the only reason they got that was because they didn't score. And so they had to keep on attacking. So it's a sort of slightly sort of nuanced statistic. If you're scoring late goals, it tends to be because you need to score late goals. But at the minute, they are doing that. And yeah, I'm sure they'll win fairly comfortably on Sunday. But my concern would be, do you really need to go to the emotional well and draw that deep in games against Brighton and Sheffield United when there are clearly bigger challenges to come?
Yeah, and George, since we last did a podcast, since we all last spoke, it's been revealed that Xabi Alonso is unlikely to take the Liverpool or Bayern Munich jobs. In fact, it's not unlikely. It's not going to happen. Where does that leave Liverpool now in terms of their managerial search, in your opinion? I don't think there's an obvious standout candidate for what is going to be one of the toughest acts to follow in Premier League history.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's, we've seen so many times the managers who come in to replace, people like Klopp, whether it's Ferguson, Wenger, we've seen others in the past too, they generally struggle because levels have been so high. You probably have a squad of players who are pretty despondent about the change. If Liverpool do go out on a high this season, having won the league, it probably makes the job a little bit easier. But even so, there aren't really many obvious candidates. De Zerbi is obviously one, but you have to think that his star is falling a little bit at the moment with Brighton kind of limping over to the end of the season. There's been some talk around him not signing a new contract. He's very publicly kind of refused to say that he will do, and it kind of feels like their journey together is ending. Amorim, there's a lot of speculation, but there's also talk that Barcelona very much interested in bringing him in to replace Xavi over the summer, which could make things difficult. So that, it's going to be interesting to see which way they go. I definitely don't think he'll get the job, so I think it's too soon, but it's interesting to note that Fernando Torres was called in to shadow Klopp last week because he is getting some reputation as a manager working with the Atletico Madrid youth teams for the style of play and the way that he's improving certain players. And obviously, Xabi Alonso plucked straight from Real Sociedad B into the Leverkusen top job, and that hasn't gone too badly, which might, if things really do get difficult, maybe the thinking around getting him in was to have a proper look at his coaching credentials. But as I say, it's probably a little bit early for Torres, but it wouldn't surprise me if he's a Liverpool manager in the future, especially given there isn't really a clear succession plan of him at Atleti, given Simeone doesn't look like he's going anywhere soon.
Yeah, we've got the numbers of Amorim and De Zerbi coming up on the screen now, Jonathan. His win percentage, oh no, he's not, that's the pass success rate of his team. I thought his win percentage was 85.8%, and I've read that completely wrong. Can we read too much into Amorim's record in Portugal when discussing him for this Liverpool job? Obviously, it's very, very different, isn't it?
I mean, you're still looking at track record, and the fact is Sporting hadn't won the league there for 19 years and he takes them to the title. So that's an achievement. You can't say it's not an achievement.
It's 84.6%, by the way, so I hadn't read it that wrong.
Well done.
That's fucking right.
See, you've got to give them credit for that. But yes, they're one of the big three in Portugal, but they haven't been habitual winners recently. I know it fell away a bit last season. They only finished fourth, but they're going well again this season. When we've seen them in Europe, they've been impressive in some games, less so in others, and that maybe is a slight concern. I think the big doubt over Amorim is the fact he's always played a back three. At Braga, he played a back three. At Sporting, he plays a back three. I'm not sure this Liverpool squad is not impossible to turn it into a team that plays a back three, but that's not the way they've been playing. So if you're looking for continuity, that is something that maybe would just sort of raise a question mark. But I mean, that is as simple as at the interview saying, are you going to carry on playing a back three? And if so, how are you going to do it? And you see what his answer is. But it's a question you need to ask. So that is a doubt. I think we're in a really, we're at a phase of football history where, on the one hand, it seems like the politics and the finance is sort of overshadowing everything, because that's so, it feels so existential to the game. But at the same time, this is a really, really interesting summer, just from footballing points of view. Yeah. Loads of big clubs, you have Barcelona, Bayern, Liverpool, probably Juventus, are looking for new coaches. And it feels a little bit like the old generation of coaches has moved on, that this is a new generation coming through, and none of them have quite proved themselves yet. So the fact that the two major candidates for this job appear to be Amorim, only coached in Portugal, De Zerbi, has never coached a big club, or a super club, maybe is a fair way of putting that. It's a risk whoever you turn to. There's no sort of Ancelotti, Mourinho figure who has got this, a track record of winning Champions Leagues. So I feel this is a summer where a lot of future narratives are going to be determined this summer. And that does give it a sort of a slightly chaotic aspect. And I think with Amorim, I don't know, I feel like we've been waiting for almost a decade for the next great Portuguese manager to step up. And there's been loads of candidates, like Paulo Fonseca, Marco Silva, Jardim, Rui Vitória. There's hundreds of them. And is Amorim the one who is actually finally going to do it? Possibly. I think he will. It's just whether it's at Liverpool, whether it's at Barcelona, I think is the question.
Let's live in a world where Richard Hughes hasn't just been onboarded at Liverpool, George. You've got Odison Edouard's number on speed. Yeah. John Terry's ringing you every 5 minutes to try and get involved. Mm-hmm. You're sporting director of Liverpool. Who do you choose to be the next manager?
I think Amorim feels like the one with the highest ceiling. As Jonathan mentions there, it feels like he could be, you want to take someone who's destined to be one of the top managers or head coaches in world football. And with De Zerbi, it feels like there are doubts. The arc of his success in both of his last two jobs has been fairly similar, with massive promise and obviously a playing style that is exciting and may translate better to having one of the best squads in world football. But at the same time, when the drop off is quite quick after that, then alarm bells ring. Whereas with Amorim, it's hard to translate what he's done across into a Premier League or a La Liga. But I think in terms of the potential upside, it's there purely on that basis, on a profile basis, because I think the style of play is very different and their personality is very different. It was a similar thinking with Ten Hag, where it felt like he needed to get him out of Ajax in order to let him kind of flower into one of the top coaches in world football, and that hasn't happened. So I think Amorim is the one, but it doesn't come without its risks.
Yeah, and Jonathan, let's live in a world where you're about to start a podcast called Wilson's Lists, and you're asked to compile a list of prospective Liverpool managers. Who do you choose? Who's your number one?
I don't know. I think it's really difficult.
We ask the tough questions on this show.
I mean, I'm back. Hello.
I lost you.
Did I disappear there?
I thought it was just a really long pause.
So yeah, but the day that Javi Alonso said he was staying, I had to write a piece on this. And I'd seen that Amorim had been linked, and I'd seen that Zerbi had been linked, and Pep Linders, who Klopp's assistant, who's leaving the club, but maybe he could be persuaded to stay on and carry on the legacy directly. And then I just sort of looked at bookmakers' lists of who the favourites are. There's some really odd names in there. So Thomas Tuchel, for instance, who seems to me, if you failed at PSG and you failed at Bayern, the chance of getting the Liverpool job are pretty low. I mean, I quite like Tuchel. I think he deserves another chance. But I also think it's going to be the equivalent of a mid-table Premier League club first. And I wonder, if you're going for somebody with Premier League experience, and I think there is always a danger of looking abroad and seeing an exoticism there. And because you're not quite so familiar with their work, you don't see the flaws. Whereas when you're watching them 38 times a season, you do see. So if you're looking for somebody who is in the Premier League at the moment, maybe the best candidate of current Premier League managers is Marco Silva. It felt sort of, say, 5 years ago that he was ready to take that step up, and it didn't quite work out. You obviously have a problem. He's a former Everton manager. Maybe that's just not acceptable. But of current Premier League candidates, maybe he is the one who could do it.
I mean, I don't want to manifest this, But I always think it's quite, I find it quite disrespectful that, like, De Zerbi, for example, is heavily linked with this job. Why would Unai Emery not be on a list of managers for Liverpool? I don't want this to happen. And maybe it's because people think that he won't leave Villa with the position that they're in. But I actually think he'd be a really good fit for Liverpool.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, it still feels to me like the successes of Unai Emery's career so far has been at clubs of a similar profile to Villa, where it's not massive expectation to go win a league. It's overperforming previous, you know, levels of or league finishes, and also giving a good show in some of the minor European competitions going. So
you got to say we've got another Champions League, George.
But I also think they would look at the Arsenal experience, which was very similar in terms of him coming in after Arsene Wenger, coming into a club looking to break away from a previous wildly successful manager, albeit it's very unlikely that Klopp is going to have the drop off that we saw Wenger have late on, well, in the last decade or so of his Arsenal tenure. So I'd be surprised. And also, I think that Villa would make life very, very difficult for Liverpool if they wanted to get Unai Emery, because I'm sure the amount of money it would cost to get him out would probably make it a high risk and fairly high cost option.
Nagelsmann, Jonathan, that's where I potentially see it going. I know he's in the job. I know he, you know, depending on how far Germany go in the Euros, he might go into July. Is he a fit?
Possibly. I mean, his contract with Germany ends at the end of the Euros, yeah. So there's no issue with that. I think Bayern are very interested in bringing him back, whether he would want that, given what happened.
Why did they get rid of him?
I mean, I think my doubt over Nagelsmann is twofold. One is he just seems like a really weird bloke. I'm in a glass house and chucking stones when I say that.
I didn't like to say.
But, yeah, turning up on a skateboard to training, I'm not sure that goes down well at Liverpool or Bayern, or indeed anywhere outside, you know, a 14-year-old's youth club. I think repeatedly in big European games, he's been found wanting. And to an extent, that's a little bit unfair, because he's been going to those with Hoffenheim or with Leipzig, where he has had the weaker squad. But I think there's times when he's got those badly wrong, the big games. But yeah, what he's done with Germany, all right, he's only been in the job, you know, a matter of weeks, but he seems to have taken the Germany side that was drifting badly, and he's given them a sense of purpose. And the last two friendlies, they played really, really well. So I think his stock is already rising again, and people are remembering, oh yeah, beyond the skateboards and the wacky clothes, and just the sheer oddness, there is actually a very, very talented coach there. But that issue of the big European games is what concerns me. So he's in the Kloppian lineage. It makes some kind of sense. The other figure he seems to just I'm not suggesting this necessarily for Liverpool, but in terms of more broadly for this summer, of a big name manager who's floating about, everybody seems to have forgotten about, is Hansi Flick.
I assumed he'd go back to Bayern, that was my assumption.
Well, that also could happen, but his time with Germany, it was so bad that I think it's been made to look worse by how well Nagelsmann appears to be doing. I mean, obviously that could change come the Euros, but my suspicion is that hosts tend to overperform in tournaments anyway. Qatar obviously being an example, but yeah, hosts tend to do better than you think they'll do. So I suspect Nagelsmann will come out of the summer with his reputation enhanced, and yeah, by contrast, because he, you know, with the same group of players and the same circumstances, he did so much worse. Flicks will be diminished, but. I think Flick still has, you know, he's only in his mid-50s. I think there's still life to be wrung out of him.
Yeah. I mean, we could talk about next Manchester United manager here, but we'll toe the football line. If he's still in the job, it's very, very disrespectful. Obviously, we know that Liverpool are going to be looking for a manager in the summer. We should talk about the game a little bit, I suppose, as well. Manchester United v Liverpool, I believe it's a 3:30 kickoff on Sunday, George. Can we read anything? I mean, should we take too much from that crazy FA Cup game? Surely this is going to be just business as usual for Liverpool, especially in light of what happened last night.
Possibly. I think there's probably something in the game from a couple of weeks ago. Like, I think United putting in their best performance for a long time up against this side will give them some hope going into it. It shows that, you know, certainly from a tactical battle where Ten Hag's come off second best in loads of games this season against Klopp. It hasn't necessarily always been the case. And sometimes you will get certain managers who you may not think are as good as the other one, but have a very good record over them. And that seems to be the case here. I mean, I expect Liverpool to be much better on the day, and I expect them to be the better team, and I expect them to win. But I wouldn't be as bullish about that, given the, you know, what we've seen United do against Liverpool in the last couple of seasons. But I mean, not always, because obviously there was a game last season where they were absolutely hammered. But, certainly this season has been, they seem to enjoy playing Liverpool, which you can't say about many teams.
I mean, if Manchester United win this, I'll offer to do the podcast every week at 7 a.m. I just can't. I can't see that happening.
I would suit me, actually, so I'm all for that.
You're all for that. So you and Jonathan hoping for a Manchester United win this week, and I bet he hasn't predicted a Manchester United win, though, in his predictions that are becoming more and more crucial by the week. We'll come on to them later on in the show. Who do you actually want to win the league, Jonathan? I don't know, because obviously you're a top level journalist. Maybe you can't say, but do you have a team out of the three that is your preference to win the league?
No, I don't care. I think it's better for the league if it's not City. Yeah, I think change is good. What I want is a proper title race, and by that I mean not just multiple teams in it, but ideally teams dropping points, twists and turns. Or at least like last night, Sheffield United making Liverpool really have to work for those points. I mean, to be fair, Villa did for City the day before as well. But what we don't want, was that title race, when was it? The season when it was sort of 99, 98 points, when Liverpool and City won the last 11 games of the season each or something.
Like, and it Villa gave City the league in the last game.
That was 2 years ago. It was before that. And it was just sort of, it was just a procession where, it looks close because there's, had City drawn and Liverpool won, Liverpool would have won the league. But they both kept winning games very straightforwardly. And it was very, very dull, even though there was only 1 point in it. And they were sort of chasing each other down the straight for a third of the season. What you want is a team drops points and another team drops points. And you want it to look like it's in City's hands, and then no, it's in Arsenal's hands, and then no, it's in Liverpool's hands. And you want there to be twists and turns. You don't want them just to each win every game from now to the end of the season. I think that would be the duller way of it happening. But yeah, if it's like last night where they have to fight for the points, then that's not too bad. But I think that's why ideally your title winner should be getting sort of 80 to 85 points. And then the space for teams to drop points and to come back, and you can have a little bad run, and rather than you lose three games and that's it, you're out of the race. I don't care who wins, but I just hope it is a proper race. As I say, I think when a team starts winning six titles out of seven, which it will be if City were to win it, I think you ask questions about the competitiveness of the league.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely would have City third from a purely kind of competitive point of view. I personally, I know a lot of fans of some clubs would look at the Liverpool situation and how they, when they won the league, their fans weren't able to be there and enjoy it and find that amusing. I personally don't have any animosity towards Liverpool fans. So I think for them, being able to actually enjoy their team winning the Premier League would be a good thing. And similarly, I think Arsenal in many ways deserve it because I think the strides they've taken over the last couple of seasons, the way they've developed brilliant English talent, looking at Bukayo Saka and Ben White and having Declan Rice in the middle of in centre midfield as well. But you can say the same about Liverpool. So I don't really mind. Either of those two would be good for me, albeit my brother-in-law and all my nephews are Arsenal fans, so I should probably say that.
Okay, then. Interesting. I mean, it says here, Jonathan, has Liverpool's title push gone somewhat under the radar given the circumstances? So alluding to injuries, Trent, Alisson, Salah, Jota, Robertson, Jones, they've had some massive injuries through this season. I'm not really sure a title push can go under the radar when you're actually top of the league. That works.
I mean, I presume what it means is has what Klopp's done been slightly underappreciated?
Yeah.
I mean, I also hate that kind of question because you then have to assess, to what extent is it rated? Look, Klopp's done an incredible job this season to pick them up from where they were last season and to get them in position they're in now. Would be an extraordinary job even without the injuries. The fact they had all these injuries and they keep finding new players yeah, you have to give them a huge credit. And that's the fact that a lot of youth team products have been brought in probably before they wanted to bring them in. That speaks incredibly well of the system that's in place. So all of that is hugely positive. I would also say, I think City have had injuries in key positions this season. I mean, no John Stones, Kyle Walker missing a couple of games, De Bruyne have been out for a huge part of the season. Yeah, they've had major injuries as well. Maybe not as many. Well, definitely not as many as Liverpool. But injuries seem to be a thing that are getting worse and worse and worse. I mean, everything we say about United, you have to also point out, United have had horrendous injuries, particularly at centre-back this season. I mean, they were without four of the centre-backs. The last two games, they've lost four. Yeah, they lost Lindelof and Martinez against Brentford, and then they lost Varane and Evans last night. So, you know, no team can cope easily with losing four centre-backs. Kambwala looked fine, actually, when he came on. I wouldn't blame him at all for how things went. I saw his debut against West Ham just before Christmas. He looked very composed, very good. I think he's probably going to be a very good player, but you wouldn't want him to be playing, I think it's eight games now this season that he's played. That obviously wasn't part of the plan. So Newcastle have had terrible injuries, particularly at centre-back. I don't know, centre-back seems to be the new fashionable position to get injured.
What was it before? What was the fashionable position before centre-back?
Oh, that's a good question. Actually, maybe it's been centre-backs for a while, because Liverpool had that season when they were playing Fabinho and Jordan Henderson as centre-back, because the centre-backs were injured. True. Maybe centre-backs have a new danger position. Maybe centre-backs should be paid more because it's such a dangerous job.
Yeah, Tottenham had two full-backs at centre-back earlier on in the season as well.
Yeah, Van der Ven pulling his hamstring, yeah. Maybe we're asking centre-backs to do things that their bodies aren't equipped to do, that they're asking them to be too quick given their bulk.
Something that needs investigating for sure.
But yes, look, if the question is, has Klopp done a brilliant job? The answer is yes.
Well, okay, then let's take a little break to look at the combined 11, and we'll play our usual game, George, of guessing how many Manchester United players have made the 11. I mean, you will get one. you'll just get it. He's got shares in who scored. He's in the 11, I can reveal.
I reckon three.
Three? Okay. Jonathan?
Well, there's the obvious two. So there's Onana and Bruno Fernandes, who are definitely in. Question is to the third. Dallow's had quite a good season, and that's maybe awesome. Maybe hasn't been because we've had to sort of chop and change quite a lot. Maybe Liverpool fullbacks aren't quite as highly rated. So I'm going to say three, and I'm going to say Dallow is the third.
To be fair, this team was done before the games last night, and Conor Bradley scored no goal, so there maybe is a chance that he would have been removed from this now. But at the time, the graphic I have in front of me.
Sorry, carry on.
As I say, he's in, and you're both wrong. It's two Manchester United players. It is Onana, and it is Bruno Fernandes. So we've got Onana in goal, Bradley, Konate, Van Dijk, and Robertson as the back four, McAllister, Fernandes, and Shabazz Lai as the midfield, and then Salah, Nunez, and Diaz is the front three. No major surprises in that 11. Bruno Fernandes has got the most key passes, George, across the entirety of the Premier League this season with 89. He's in the combined 11, which is obviously a monumental achievement. Still, when I watch him, I'm just not seeing what I would expect if I was a Manchester United player. His style of leadership of basically being a big baby doesn't inspire me at all. You know, he gets in things like this combined 11. Everyone talks about what a good player he is. You know, having a great season for me.
It's a really interesting one with Bruno, because most neutrals think as you do, and especially with leadership qualities, underwhelming generally. If you speak to a lot of United fans, they adore him and think that he's been the one shining light for them this season, and really appreciate the way that he works as well. Like, I can't think of many players where opinion is so divided between the fan base and the neutral. I don't watch him every week. United on telly quite a lot. I see him a fair bit. He still seems to be comfortably their most creative player. He's a big goal threat. You'd probably ideally want him to do a bit more, but it's product, I think, of being in a pretty poor team that he doesn't. And when you've got United fans who, you know, he still gets abuse from some quarters, but I know a fair few who are very keen on Bruno and worry that if he leaves, then things really will fall apart. So maybe in this case, the algorithm's got something.
Where would he go? Let's say Bruno did leave, Jonathan. Where would he go? Who would pick Bruno Fernandes? What's his level? Where does he sit?
I don't know, because he's not a modern sort of player. I think the reason he's made so many key passes is the way United play. The fact that they've got three runners ahead of him. So he is the creative midfielder. His job is just to feed them. So he's always going to get loads of key passes because of that. Where would he go? I don't know. I'm just not sure he's defensively he's sound enough to play for a top team. And therefore, United's probably about the right club for him. But I was thinking about this, that, you know, in terms of how we value players, like imagine the only way you could buy a player was using a token that was worth, say, £50 million. In that circumstance, if you were building a new United squad, which players would you keep and which would you take the token for? And I think I would keep maybe Onana, maybe touch and go. Bruno Fernandes, probably yes. Højlund, yes. And probably Garnacho. And I'm not sure there's any others where I wouldn't be thinking Cobby. Very seriously. Cobby Mano. Yeah, that's fair. Yeah. But again, 50 million quid for him, like, you know, I'm not sure. Probably I'd keep him, you're right. But yeah. I'd be tempted because he's only 18, you never quite know. But there's not many, is my point. And Bruno Fernandes is definitely one of them. And I think the fact that Onana is possibly one of them. I think to replace him for 50 million quid is not easy for one of my tokens.
I quite like that to be a thing. Mm-hmm. That makes player trading a lot easier if you just get a token for 50 million for anyone that you don't want.
And yeah, contracts are irrelevant. Just, you know.
Just tokens.
Yeah, just tokens.
Yeah, I mean, Jonathan says there if he wouldn't take the token for Onana potentially there, George.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, so, yes, yeah. I confused myself with my own metaphor. Yes, that's correct.
I mean, Anana's dad's been in the script here writing it. He says, United have the biggest XG against overperformance in the Premier League, so are conceding far fewer than expected. As such, does Andre Onana deserve more credit than he is getting? It feels like people are still judging him on the big errors earlier this season, but perhaps that inevitable combined 11 spot is deserved. That's a who scored official statement. I'm taking that as a justification as well.
I think there's something to it. I think with goalkeeper...
The first goal last night.
Yeah, it was poor.
Yeah, but that happens all the time.
But it is one of those things, when you're looking at keepers, that the 4, 5, 6 mistakes are always going to stick in your memory. And the small things that they do don't. And, you know, I personally think you don't have the best goals prevented rate or whatever that overperformance was compared to XG in the league, unless you're doing something right. It's just, you know, if you're looking at post-shot XG numbers and if Onana is outperforming that, that is a representation of the factual elements of his performance. Like that doesn't happen by fluke. So there's got to be something in that. His distribution is obviously good.
I'm not knocking his distribution, but he's shot.
Part of it has to be because they can see more shots than anyone else. So he's under pressure than anybody else to do it. You know, I think, for example, when he was at Inter, you didn't see these kind of mistakes because they were a very solid defensive side. So I agree with Jonathan. I think he'd be hard to replace. I think it's his first season at the club as well. And I think he probably does get a little bit of a harder time than maybe he deserves, despite the fact that he clearly does make errors.
I feel like every time I watch him, he makes an error. I'm fortunate enough that, you know, I get to watch Emi Martinez playing goal every single week for my team. He's absolutely
never
making
an error.
And I'm cursing him now and he'll make a mistake at the weekend, absolutely. But he doesn't make mistakes. And I know all goalkeepers really make mistakes. But, you know, to use another terrible analogy, I mean, Jonathan was absolutely buzzing with the De Sassi Minecraft analogy in the WhatsApp group last night.
It's not mine either,
but you get what I mean with the way he moved. And Arna's like, you might as well have Mr. Tickling goal because his hands aren't where you would expect them to be ever. It's always like flimsy and going through. He should save that one last night.
Oh, I would take Mr. Tickling goal.
No, you wouldn't. I think his hands are too thin. I think his arms are too thin.
I don't know. Like, I'd He'd be coming for crosses, claiming crosses he has no right to get.
Neither.
He's quite big of body as well, isn't he? He'd get in the way of a lot. But I think of all the Mr. Men, if I was going to pick one and go, it'd be Mr. Tickle.
I think I'd have Mr. Bump, because I think he'd always get in the way. He doesn't want to, but he just gets in the way, Mr. Bump.
He'd be like an Egyptian goalkeeper. He's always going down, getting treatment, killing the game, running the clock down. I would hate Mr. Bump if he was in goal.
George, have you got any Mr. Man or Little Miss that you'd like to...
Yeah,
I tell you who's got arms
Mr.
a bit
Perfect,
like
Mr. surely.
Mr. Perfect? I didn't even know that was one.
Yeah.
I think that's a late blossoming one. I think that's come through the youth system. I don't think I was there in my day.
No, not
tell you who looks a bit like Mr. Tickle in terms of his arms. Thomas Müller. His arms are far too long for his body.
Yeah, he doesn't look. I can certainly see a resemblance there.
Andre Maher as well. Not a footballer, but yeah, also
amazing.
Surprisingly long arms.
He looks like Mr. Tickle, or you'd have him in goal for United.
I wouldn't have him in goal, but okay. he's got Mr. Tickle arms, like massive arms. Just go on and on forever.
But do you see what I'm saying about Onana? Like, his arms yesterday for that first goal are not where you would expect.
Well, okay, now there's a technical issue here. And when he was at Ajax, they tested this out. They sort of said to him, look, your base position is too low, your arms are too close to your body. And so he tried to do what they were telling him to do. And they realised that for whatever reason with him, his reaction times are actually better in that unorthodox position. Now, I don't know why that would be, but that is something that goalkeeping coaches have looked at and have decided, actually, no, you're better off sticking with this slightly odd arms into the body, slightly lower position.
Okay, interesting.
And I also think with that first goal yesterday, so I think there's an issue with Onana's positioning that I think he occasionally gets caught too deep. I think that creates these issues. The closer you are to the striker, obviously within reason, the more the more you're narrowing the angle down, the further away you are, the more you're creating the opportunity for an angle to go slightly wrong. But also, I just think if you're facing 20 shots a game, the chances of one of them just bouncing off the wrong bit of your body become quite high. I think, I don't know, let's say 1 in 20 shots will hit the goalkeeper's body and go in because the position will be fractionally wrong because it'll bounce slightly funny because you've slightly misread the spin on it. Well, that just happens a lot to Onana because he faces a lot of shots. I think all keepers let in goals like that. You just see it more with him.
Yeah, I mean, if you're this all-encompassing sweeper keeper, though, should you be too far back?
No, I think that is an issue with him. I think you see that in one-on-ones, and particularly early in the season. There were times in one-on-ones he appeared to just sort of dematerialise. I think that's something to do with starting position, which is weird because, as you say, one of his gifts is his passing and the fact he leaves his box. But I think at times his starting position is too deep, and I think that was an example of it last night.
Okay. Should we play a bit of Manchester United shots being go? We were all well off it last week. Brentford, did they have in the end 107 shots? What was it?
31, I think it was. Was it 31?
31, yeah. None of us got that. So, we're back to... this is.
Well, I wasn't here, to be fair.
That's true, but we are back
you,
to...
You when, and Sam are the same, the same person for purposes.
When I say that, I'm talking about your team. You were very much... I felt a lot of team spirit within the WhatsApp group with you and Sam this week.
Well, he's pulled his finger out now, hasn't he?
Yeah, for the first time, he's taken until till March, April, hasn't he? But when it's come to the business end, he does seem to have come alive, doesn't he?
He had a very good weekend last weekend, fair play.
Yes, he did. I mean, we might as well talk about this. Now, I'm not top of the league. Jonathan and Sam on 190, myself on 186, and George on 162. Yeah, it's a big week this week. I am seriously on the decline. I've been on the decline for a long, long time in this game now, but getting away with it, and I'm no longer getting away with it. And there's more pressure now. Jonathan's in the WhatsApp group because I feel like he asks about the predictions more than anyone else did. Would he be asking if he wasn't pushing towards the top of the league? I'm not sure. But now he's top.
Obviously
he's,
not. But like,
it has become probably the most important thing that there is.
And given I can see your ongoing disintegration, then I'll keep on applying the pressure.
Yeah, I have completely buckled. There's no getting away from it. Should we do Manchester United shots bingo there? That's what we're all here for. Jonathan, I'll let you go first. What were you going to go
Well,
for?
The game in December, I think it was 34. I think the cup game, although obviously there's extra time involved, was 25.
25, I got there. I believe I won that week, yeah.
So I think United will... They can't be as bad defensively as they were last night. Liverpool do look very good when they get going. I think to an extent it depends if Liverpool score early. I'm going to say 28.
28? So what are you going to do, George?
Yeah, 27 then.
I was going to say, I was going to be honest, I was going to say 26.
Wow.
So we'll go for that. But yeah, Brentford 31, was it?
What we should do with this is we should write down a bit of paper and hold it up simultaneously, like on the weakest link.
That's true. Yeah. Okay, we'll do that. That does seem. But what would we then have the same?
We have the same. That's how we
allow that.
You split the pot. I mean, there isn't even.
I suppose I'm acting like us having the same would be a horrendous thing. But when we do the predictions, quite often the results are the same, and they do have to be inputted before the show. Let's do predictions for Manchester United against Liverpool, which I can reveal now because of the time. Will be the only game that we talk about on Edge of the Box this week because I have not managed the show particularly well. We were supposed to do Tottenham v Forest as well, and we've run out of time to do that. But you know, maybe the general public are more interested in Manchester United v Liverpool. Prediction, please, Jonathan.
2-1 to Liverpool.
2-1 to Liverpool, George.
3-1 to Liverpool.
And that is exactly what I've done as well. 3-1 to Liverpool. Yeah. And we had to input these before the games last night. Would I have changed my score based on last night's result? Probably not. We can have a brief word on Tottenham v Forest, I guess, Jonathan. The Nuno derby. People forget, you know, you forget Nuno was manager of Tottenham Hotspur going back to his
beat City on his first game.
He did, 1-0. Can you remember who scored that day?
Oh, was that the game as well? No.
I'm asking that question without knowing the answer myself.
I can't remember either.
I had a feeling it was a centre-back for some reason. But...
Oh, I can hear typing.
I've in my head it was a set-piece defender.
Any guesses before I ruin it?
I mean, Kane would be too obvious to guess. Son would be too obvious to guess. That'd be boring.
Might be boring.
Kane.
Son.
Yeah. I had in my head that it was a header from a set piece for some reason. I don't know. Maybe it was a set piece. I mean, that was many moons ago. Like I said, you forget that Nuno was actually the manager of Tottenham Hotspur.
Yeah, I mean, it was a totally uneventful rain, wasn't it? They got that win and then it just became very sort of damp and musty very quickly.
Yeah, my Brennan Johnson returning to his former club as well, George, raised in the EFL as we all know. Kind of in and out the team, but actually when he's sub, it tends to work better for Tottenham at Vale.
Nice story about, I'm sure I've told you this before, you said made in the EFL, but he's
raised
in the EFL.
You should know that's your own show, that was.
I know.
Yeah.
Brennan Johnson's dad, David Johnson, was teammates and very good friends with Michael Appleton. And when Brennan Johnson wasn't getting a look in at Forest, that was where the loan to Lincoln came about, from which he then flourished and became a £50 million player, which is mad, really, when you consider that his pathway to Forest may have been blocked if that hadn't happened. But, I mean, he's quality. And what's been great to see with Johnson over the course of this season is that he has been... Ange Postecoglou has been so patient with him, which is good, because I think often when you get players who step up, they're often brought into the side and taken out very quickly. If they don't perform, people start writing them off. I think with Johnson, he's got consistent minutes in his best position. If he hasn't produced goals or assists early on, there hasn't been a huge clamour to take him out of the side. He's been allowed to develop, allowed to get used to you know, the environment that he's now in and kind of stepping up his level. And he's now doing it. I think he's going to be a great player for them. I don't think he'll ever be a superstar. I don't think he'll ever be a Son, for example. I don't think his goal output will ever be that high, but I think he'll be a very handy player for Spurs to have going forward. And it's good to see that he's doing what he's doing now, albeit it will be devastating for Forest fans if he was to play a part in beating them on, was it Sunday? And, you know, given their perilous position after the points deduction, which, would be frustrating for them.
Yeah, I mean, it feels inevitable that he will score against them at the weekend. I've gone for 3-1. To Tottenham for this one. George, what have you gone for?
I have gone for 2-0 Spurs.
2-0 Spurs, Jonathan?
I've gone for 2-1 Spurs.
2-1 Spurs, a bit of jeopardy in there. Let's rattle through the rest of our predictions then. Palace v City, Jonathan?
2-0 City.
2-0 City, George?
3-0 City.
I've gone for 3-1 City, which is now three predictions of 3-1 from the first three. So... I'm not sure that's the wisest strategy when chasing to just predict the same score for every game. Villa v Brentford, I've gone for 2-0 to Villa, Jonathan.
2-1 to Villa.
2-1 to Villa. George?
1-1.
1-1. Don't like that. Don't like that at all. Everton against Burnley, please, George.
1-0 Everton.
Everton, Jonathan?
Yeah, snap, 1-0 Everton.
I've gone for 2-1 to Burnley, so that feels like a critical game there. Yeah, I'm not sure why. When did I do
really
this?
Really lost your head here.
What was going on?
Everton without winning 14 now, aren't they? So, yeah, so maybe. And Burnley are picking up.
Exactly.
They've been a bit better last couple of weeks.
That's what I was thinking when I made this prediction. Fulham v Newcastle, Jonathan.
2-1 Fulham.
2-1 Fulham, George.
2-2.
And I have gone for 1-1. Luton against Bournemouth, please, George.
1-1.
1-1, Jonathan.
2-1 Bournemouth.
I've gone for another 3-1. Luton 3, Bournemouth 1, my fourth 3-1 prediction. So there'll be no 3-1s at the weekend. You can almost certainly guarantee that now. Wolves against West Ham. I've gone for Wolves 1, West Ham 1. Jonathan?
There's never been a game that's been more 1-1 than this. It's obviously 1-1.
1-1. George?
2-1 Wolves.
Oh, George doesn't think it's obvious. 2-1 to Wolves. Brighton against Arsenal, please, Jonathan.
2-1 Arsenal.
2-1 to Arsenal, George.
2-0 Arsenal.
I've gone for 3-0 to Arsenal.
Not 3-1.
Nah, 3-0 this time. Mix it up a bit. Kind of half your results being 3-1, can you? Right, we've done United, Liverpool, so, and we've done Spurs, Forest also. So this is another rogue shout from me. I've gone Sheffield United 2, Chelsea 2. George.
I've done a Bardell. 3-1 Chelsea.
3-1 to Chelsea. Jonathan?
2-1 to Chelsea.
Why did I do that? What, I don't know where I'm. No wonder I'm just lost the lead if I'm just throwing in predictions like
this. This could be the week that I close the gap.
Yeah, I haven't got a single team scoring 3 this weekend, which I'm slightly concerned by. Yeah, lots of 2-1s.
I wouldn't be too concerned by it.
Seven of them 2-1. I've got.
Oh, that's worse than my 4-3 ones then.
Well, I think 2-1 is the most common score though, doesn't it?
That would make sense because I've only got 1-2-1 in my 10 predictions, so that would make sense that was the most common score. Right, it'd be interesting anyway, and I'm sure we'll all be in touch on the WhatsApp group through the weekend to discuss this. Thank you. Thank you, everyone. Thank you to you two, sorry, for joining me. Thanks to everyone for watching the show as well. Apologies to Tottenham and Forest fans. We seriously overran on the Manchester United v Liverpool segment. I might even be getting a telling off the Who Scored bosses, but I'm sure they won't mind. And Anana's got his weekly place in the combined 11 as well, which is all that really matters when we're doing the show. We'll be back next week to once again preview the Premier League action. But wherever you are taking your podcast, if you could subscribe to us, like us, do all the things that help the podcast appear in places it wouldn't normally appear, then that would be absolutely brilliant. We do read all the comments that come in. We're very appreciative of the kind words there. Yeah, enjoy all the football at the weekend. Promises to be another excellent weekend. Have a good weekend and tell all your friends and family about the show.